Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. In which what was predicted seems to be coming true. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 26th of January. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Had you wondered in your idle hours what the opening salvo of a trade war sounded like? This may well have been it.
The president of Mexico and myself have agreed to cancel our planned meeting scheduled for next week. Unless Mexico is going to treat the United States fairly, with respect, such a meeting would be fruitless, and I want to go a different route. A
couple of things about that clip. The president speaking today at the Republican retreat in Philadelphia. Of course, first of all, in keeping with our longstanding policy here at Marketplace that facts matter, the truth of this is that Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto told the White House he wasn't going to come for a meeting with the president. Second on the wall, and who's going to pay for it? White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer intimated today that the Trump administration is going to impose a 20% border tax on imports, Mexican and otherwise, and that they would pay for the wall that way, which gets us back to where we started, the bilateral Mexican-American trade relationship as the canary in the global economic coal mine. Marketplace's Jed Kim gets us going.
The U.S. and Mexican economies are tightly intertwined. Where they're a number one importer, they're our number two. Tariffs on goods one way could be countered by tariffs the other way on other goods. Gary Huffbauer is with the Peterson Institute.
Realistically, it's more likely that the U.S. economy will bear the burden of the fees than the Mexican economy.
U.S.-Mexico trade relations, important as they are only part of a wider picture. Edward Alden with the Council on Foreign Relations believes President Trump is looking to rejigger more than just imports, exports, and tariff levels.
He's looking to make a political point in U.S. relations with Mexico. We're the dominant partner. You're the subordinate partner. Get with the program.
If relations worsened, Mexico may prove less cooperative on issues like security. It might even stop regulating its own southern border, letting refugees flood across from Central America.
It's not as easy to say no to those people as it is to say no to people coming from Mexico trying to cross illegally. They actually have a right to request asylum status in the United States. It's written into U.S. laws.
The Trump administration's moves are just the opening gambits in negotiating our future relationship with Mexico. And the question of who pays for the wall may ultimately be less important than establishing a good working relationship with our southern neighbor. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
All right, so let's circle back to that GOP policy retreat here for a second. It is ostensibly about Obamacare, how to get rid of it, and what happens next. A comprehensive bill is still a ways off. This stuff is complicated. But there are some ideas all but guaranteed to make the final draft. One of them is the ability to sell insurance across state lines. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains why that matters.
Here's the pitch. Let companies sell whatever plan they want, wherever they want. That should lead to more competition and choices, and that should lower prices. Harvard Health economist Kate Baker says that could work.
There's the opportunity to improve competition, but it comes with this cost of undermining regulatory authority.
Today, under Obamacare, insurers are already able to sell insurance across state lines. But those policies must meet certain federal standards. Those include offering maternity benefits, access to mental health, and coverage for prescription drugs. We have no idea what Republicans might propose in their alternative to the Affordable Care Act. But in the past, they've said companies should be able to sell plans without these sorts of standards. The Urban Institute's Linda Blumberg says that's where the seemingly common sense idea falls off the tracks.
It leads to essentially a race to the bottom in terms of what insurers are able to sell, because anybody that's selling something more comprehensive is going to only be able to enroll, you know, much higher cost people.
If the healthiest people all gravitate to the cheapest plans, that's going to make it extraordinarily expensive for sick people.
That starts to create a risk pool imbalance.
Christine Groh is the spokesperson for AHIP, a trade group that represents many companies in the industry.
When that happens, that's when you start to see the premiums go up for everyone. So that's a situation that we're very much wanting to avoid.
Groh says insurers are making that point very clear to Congress. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Here's today's energy market update. With a president and a cabinet more fossil fuel than renewable, the state of New York is staking a claim on wind. A power company serving Long Island just signed a contract to buy gobs and gobs of offshore wind power, a deal that comes even though offshore wind is still relatively expensive. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong from the Sustainability Desk.
This would be just the second offshore wind farm in the U.S. And this energy isn't cheap. Offshore wind energy costs twice as much as natural gas and triple that of wind power made on land. But sometimes it makes sense for big cities that don't have any space for power plants or overhead lines, says analyst Tom Harris at Bloomberg New Energy Finance.
Offshore offers you the expanse of the ocean to erect wind turbines, but also it sort of conquers the not-in-my-backyard approach from some people who don't like the look of wind turbines or solar panels. You can effectively build an offshore wind farm out of sight of the coast.
New York State has a broader plan to build an East Coast offshore wind market to make the energy cheaper. Last year, costs fell more than 20% as the makers of turbines and other parts did it for less, says Jonathan Meir at the investment bank Lazard.
So they have always surprised us by doing better than we would have thought in their ability to take costs out of their products.
There is federal uncertainty. The new administration could end renewable tax credits or stop auctioning off ocean space. And yet the developers keep coming, the latest being an oil company, Statoil from Norway. David Osterberg, environment professor at the University of Iowa, says offshore oil, offshore wind, they're not so different.
Statoil, they can use that same knowledge going offshore on wind. I mean, they're an energy company and they like to make money.
They're betting that states will keep buying clean energy and that costs will keep falling. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, what do you think? Things feel different with the Dow over 20,000? Yeah, no, me neither. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The influence business in Washington is going strong, always is, after a change in administrations. But now it's happening despite the new president's vow to crack down on lobbying. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports from the heart of the beast.
So I'm standing on an icon of American lobbying, K Street in Washington, D.C. Not all lobbying firms are located here, but a huge number of them are.
So there's K&L Gates at 1601 right there. That's a big one.
This is Lee Drutman. He's giving me a tour of K Street. He's a senior fellow at New America who studies lobbying.
Aaron Fox is a law and lobbying firm.
Behind these glittering windows on K Street, things are hopping. Like in the beginning of any congressional session, lobbyists are working members of Congress, encouraging them to pass certain bills or vote against others. One reason lobbyists are especially busy, though, Drutman says the Trump administration has given lobbyists a new mission.
If you never know when President Trump is going to send out a grumpy tweet that puts your company in the spotlight, you want to make sure you have lobbyists who are building relationships with his administration so that he doesn't take any serious action to harm your company.
Drutman and I take a little detour off K Street toward the White House. Drutman says lobbyist offices are everywhere.
They just basically stretch down towards Capitol Hill, stretch east down I Street.
All the way into Fairfax, Virginia, where lobbyist Paul Miller has his office. He represents mainly small businesses.
Hey, Paul.
How are you?
I'm great.
Here's what a lobbyist's life is like right now. Miller says he's been working 15 or 16-hour days, introducing himself to new members of Congress, lobbying on repeal of the Affordable Care Act.
We've had already six bills introduced. We've had one bill go to the floor and pass. So that's faster than most sessions.
Part of the reason for the speed? For the first time since the election of 2010, one party controls both Congress and the White House and can tackle big issues. Lobbyists are scrambling to keep up with Republicans, but President Trump wants to rein them in. He says anyone who serves in his administration can't lobby for 5 years after leaving. But Miller says the ban will be tough to enforce. People will still lobby. They just won't register with the government.
I call it that shadow lobbying community. It's been happening for years. That's the real issue that needs to be addressed.
Over on Capitol Hill, Craig Holman is a lobbyist who lobbies against lobbying for the left-leaning watchdog group Public Citizen. He'd like a ban on working lobbyists taking jobs in government agencies.
So that essentially you don't see corporations capture the regulatory agencies by placing their lobbyists or CEOs on those agencies that oversee them.
Holman says he's worried Washington will return to the era of Jack Abramoff, a lobbyist at the center of a massive corruption scandal in the mid-2000s. Holman says ever since then, lobbyists have been vilified.
You know, I'm a registered lobbyist, and I'm proud of the work I do for Public Citizen. But even my own mother won't tell her neighbors that I'm a registered lobbyist.
Back on K Street, Lee Dretman tells me, even with all the talk of bans and crackdowns, lobbyists will still be out in full force, spending record amounts of money to persuade members of Congress to oppose or support legislation.
I wouldn't be surprised if we saw lobbying hit $4 billion in 2017.
And Dretman says that's just from registered lobbyists. If you count all of the unregistered people who lobby, that number would double. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Now that President Trump has done as he promised and made it the policy of the federal government to deny funding to what are called sanctuary cities, there's a dicey problem facing the mayors of those cities and state governors, in some cases, how to maintain their policies in the age of Trump. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that.
Raise your right hands.
Thousands of people are crowded together for seven city blocks along New York City's Central Park, and they're taking the oath of office.
I do solemnly swear.
I do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute my role as an American.
It's a symbolic act on the night before Donald Trump's inauguration as president. At the center of the demonstration is Trump International Hotel and Tower. 78% of New York City voters cast a ballot for Democrat Hillary Clinton in November. Katie Earle, a New York City resident, is here to support progressive causes.
Immigrant rights and justice, you know. Reproductive rights and justice. It's fighting for these values that so many New Yorkers share. I'm really grateful that de Blasio is taking a stand.
Earl is talking about New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who's on stage revving up the crowd.
You know, Donald Trump always likes to say he built a movement. Well, now it's time for us to build our movement.
Oh, yeah.
De Blasio says the city will push back on federal decisions that weaken immigration protections, climate change efforts, criminal justice reforms, and other issues. Eric Phillips, the mayor's press secretary, says the city can go about that in a few ways.
It'll be a combination of legal challenges, regulatory challenges, policy solutions, and, yeah, good old-fashioned coalition building and grassroots political activism.
The government resistance to Trump reaches further than the five boroughs. New York State, no surprise, also voted blue in the presidential election, with 58% of voters choosing Clinton. State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman says he's ready to bring legal challenges against the federal government when warranted. He says the state could also enforce its own laws more aggressively.
Whether it's civil rights laws or environmental laws or labor laws,
states can fill that gap.
Or, he says, the state could pass new laws to counter federal actions, but those cost money to implement, and funding is already a concern. Federal dollars make up nearly a third of New York State's budget and a tenth of New York City's, paying for things like affordable housing, schools, and counterterrorism. The executive order from Trump on defunding sanctuary cities raises the prospect that New York will lose a portion of its federal funding. Michael Cardozo is a partner at Proskauer Rose and was the corporation counsel under New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg.
It would be a financial disaster if the substantial amount of money the city receives from the federal government is somehow cut off.
Esther Fuchs, who teaches at Columbia University and was a special advisor to Bloomberg, says the city may have to look for alternative funding to make up for federal cuts.
You can always create fees and taxes and increase your revenue that way, but that's a dangerous game.
Of course, a lot of New York State residents voted for Donald Trump and think his policies will help the state. New York State Assemblyman and Republican Ron Castorina says Democrats should give the president a chance and that they'll have an opportunity to make their voices heard in the midterm elections.
Certainly people have spoken, and those in the minority at this time have to respect the process.
Looks like New York's Democratic leaders are not planning to wait that long. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
He hadn't even put the words vacation and rental together.
Here's a word, Airbnb. Well, it's sort of a word, but you know what I mean. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 32 points today, a tenth of 1%, 20,100. Both the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 flat to slightly lower. NASDAQ 56.55, S&P 500 26.96. Charter Communications bounced up 7.33% today on news that Verizon is considering buying the cable company. Verizon ended the day off 1.3%. Ford off 3.25% today after the company reported a 40% drop in net income over the last year. Tesla off 0.75%. General Motors slid nearly 2% today. Bond prices, why, they rose. Thanks for asking. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.51%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It wasn't all that long ago that you could head into downtown Los Angeles nearly any night of the week and not run into anybody you knew, or maybe anybody at all, for that matter. Attempts over the years to revitalize this part of town and keep it alive past 5 o'clock in the afternoon never really got too far. But downtown L.A. is seriously on the map now, as Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports.
It's hard to go more than a few blocks in downtown L.A. without having to wind around a construction zone. And the traffic? I'll let aspiring screenwriter Amy Robinson tell you.
One time I was on a bus. We waited like 20 minutes just to cross the green light to go one block.
She says people actually started cursing out the driver.
There was guys with cones directing cars to go this way. You couldn't go up this street. Like, it was just a madhouse.
A madhouse, but temporary, says Carol Schatz, head of the Downtown Center Business Improvement District. She points to something more permanent. A $1 billion gleaming glass tower, 73 stories of hotel rooms and office space.
This is the Wilshire Grand.
She says when it's finished later this year,
this will be the tallest building west of the Mississippi.
That is, with the help of a spire the length of a football field. The Wilshire is one of more than 100 new construction projects built over the past 6 years. Schatz says the last time downtown L.A. saw a construction boom like this, it was
in the 1920s, which I'm happy to say was prior to my arrival on the earth.
The downtown revitalization actually started in 2000, after the city made it easier to convert blocks of old office buildings into apartments, and lots of new housing came onto the market. Then the financial crisis hit. Steve Basham is an analyst with the real estate data firm CoStar Group. He says when the economy began to recover, downtown was ready.
In a lot of places, you'll see new offices or new retail centers being built, and then the housing will follow where the jobs and the people are going.
But in L.A., the housing came first.
It became a cool place to live, and that has generated new office development and new retail development.
All told, about $30 billion has poured into downtown construction since 2000, and it's brought more than 200,000 new jobs. The area is also getting attention from foreign investors, says Michael Soto of the real estate firm Transwestern.
Overseas investors and developers are really looking to place money here in the U.S., which is seen as still, you know, a safe investment environment.
Soto says Chinese developers have sunk more than $4 billion into upscale apartments and hotels in the past few years. The average rent for a one-bedroom apartment is about $2,500. But with so much construction happening so fast, the vacancy rate has climbed to 9%, the highest in Los Angeles. Again, Steve Basham.
That's the question with all this new building is, are there enough affluent renters to fill these spaces? And if not, what happens?
It's a fair question, considering there are more than 7,000 apartments under construction right now. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Whether you've used it or not, you probably know of Airbnb, right? The home rental service that, despite a tricky start, ultimately wound up changing how people travel and how people monetize their homes. The now $30 billion company is the subject of Lee Gallagher's new book. It's called The Airbnb Story, How Three Ordinary Guys Disrupted an Industry, Made Billions, and Created Plenty of Controversy. Lee is, of course, one of our Friday regulars, but it is so good to talk to you not on a Friday.
Guy, it's so different. Thanks for having me.
It's completely different. Maybe the place to start is with this. Airbnb is not the first home sharing company out there, right? And you talk about this in the book. So the question is, what got them to be so large?
They're not. In fact, when I first heard about them, I write about this in the book, I sort of rolled my eyes and I said to the tech reporter who said, oh, there's this new company. I said, you know, all these tech companies, they just, you know, dress something up, reissue it, and it's not a new idea. And one of the differences I think is so interesting, I spent a lot of time in the book talking about, is that Airbnb was urban. You know, VRBO and HomeAway, these other companies, they were vacation rental sites. And in fact, when Airbnb came up with this idea, somebody said to CEO Brian Chesky, oh, you know, the vacation rental business is really big. And he said he hadn't even put the words vacation and rental together. He hadn't even connected those dots. So that was a big thing because by being urban, it was really became very appealing to millennials very quickly. And it also became very disruptive to hotel companies in that way. So now Airbnb has everything. It's gotten so big that it has something to offer everybody. It's vacation and city and, you know, treehouse and everything. But that was a big point of difference.
Yeah,
exactly.
You start this book with basically your pitch meeting to Brian Chesky, the CEO and one of the three co-founders. And you lay out, obviously, what you think the book is going to be. And he says to you, with some reservation, he says, the problem with a book is that it's a fixed imprint of a company at a particular moment in time. He says, I'm 34. Our company is young. We're going to go do many things from here. His point being, you say, that it's very early in the game. Where then does Airbnb wind up?
It's so funny. It's so interesting because when he said that to me, I thought, well, yeah, but I know the story and you know, he's so close to it. He doesn't understand.
Right.
But I mean, they just launched this big push into trips and more than just the accommodation side of things. You can go have all these interesting experiences. You're soon going to be able to do something involving flights. I mean, they do have many, many, many more things planned. You know, for example, his model, he told me, is really Amazon. I mean, when they launched into this...
It's a good model.
Well, exactly. Don't we all want to be Amazon?
Yeah,
but you know, by going from just offering accommodations to offering now things involving the rest of the travel experience, you know, he sees it as when Amazon started with books, but now, you know, we buy everything on Amazon. So only as I got sort of into my reporting did I really understand what he meant. Yeah. So
can't talk about this without talking about some of the downside, right? Because it's not all sunshine.
Sure. Light.
There have been problems with discrimination on part of Airbnb hosts. There's been, I mean, all kinds of bad things happen when you open your home to people. How aware do you think the company is of its challenges in that regard? It must be like on the first thing that he checks every single day.
Yes, and the discrimination is a very, very big deal because that goes against the company's core promise and brand and mission statement, which is that, oh, anybody can belong anywhere. And that's the exact opposite of that. And that was a huge, huge crisis. Yeah. You know, the things that keep Brian Chesky up at night are, you know, when you have 2 million people staying overnight on New Year's Eve like they did on one single night, you know, lots of stuff can happen. Mm-hmm. You know, you're putting strangers together.
Yeah, it's funny. They're doing it at scale, but it's such an intimate process, right? I mean, you're going into somebody's home or you know, apartment or whatever it is and sort of staying there, you know?
It's so intimate. I mean, you're in their most personal space. And this is exactly why no investor wanted to touch it. I mean, people said this is a recipe for disaster. You're going to have blood on your hands. You know, they really thought this was a crazy idea and no one would ever do this. But yet, look at 140 million trips that have been taken on this platform. And, you know, it's now used by Gwyneth Paltrow and celebrities.
No, come on. You're not telling me Gwyneth
seriously.
Paltrow does
Yeah,
Airbnb.
She
Get
has. Look it up. It's in my book. And if you Google it, she went to Mexico
once. I read it in
once.
The book, but I had
you
to give
read
you
it.
Oh, come on. Because please. Lee Gallagher is on our air every now and then on a Friday. She's got a new book out. It's called The Airbnb Story. Lee, thanks so much.
Kai, thank you.
This final note on the way out today, back to where we started, the Mexican-American economic relationship. First of all, this tweet from South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, quote, simply put, any policy proposal which drives up costs of Corona, tequila, or margaritas is a big-time bad idea, mucho sad, end of quote. Graham's always good for one. More seriously, though, trade war is a strong phrase, one not to be used lightly. And there are lots of moving parts on each side of the border, not to mention the corridors of power in both Washington and Mexico City. In the interest of context, though, it's worth this observation on the way out. According to the U.S. Office of the Trade Representative, in 2014, 1.1 million American jobs depended on American exports to Mexico. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 32 points today. 20,100 was the number. S&P 500 and the NASDAQ basically flat. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.